Kathy Jordan.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Raymond Jordan. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. By the end of the incident in this case in the Yakima Library, Mr. Jordan had been pinched. He had been knelt upon, kneed in the chest. He'd been administered, injected a sedative against his will. And he'd been punched twice in the face. He was taken into custody and taken to the hospital, not the jail. It's undisputed that he was the only person injured in this incident. He stands convicted of 5 counts of third-degree assault.
We're pretty familiar with the facts. What evidence is in the record that would show what Mr. Jordan believed with respect to danger of injury when he took his first swing at the first EMT?
The very fact that he started swinging at the EMTs after they administered what they described as painful stimuli. So by their own admission, they had been committing what, from a reasonable person's perspective, could certainly be deemed to be harmful or offensive contact, okay. i.e. an assault.
Is a swing alone evidence that someone believes that they are in danger of injury?
Perhaps not a swing alone, but we're not looking at a swing alone. And
so
it is
a pinch and a trapezius and a sternum rub, and those are sufficient to establish with the swing evidence of a subjective belief.
Yes, Your Honor. And then you add to it the fact that he didn't just swing. He was clearly trying to keep them away from him. That's what the EMTs understood.
Yeah, that's the evidence after the first swing. One assault is based on that first swing, as I understand the information. So that's why I'm focusing on that. There's a lot more information that we know about Mr. Jordan later on.
Even that first swing, I think, could be deemed self-defense because he was already being assaulted, and a swing could certainly be an attempt to keep someone off of you. So the jury might find that that was unreasonable, but that was the jury's prerogative to determine whether or not he was reacting to this painful experience that the EMTs had already been forcing upon him. He then continued to make it clear.
How would we distinguish this case in from other cases with just a swing? I mean, isn't self-defense, if you accept your argument, available every time the defendant takes a swing at somebody after there's been any encounter at all with the victim of the swing?
I think the EMTs were still in physical contact with him. They were basically over him trying to hold him down as he was swinging at them. I think any time that someone is intruding on a person's physical person, on their body, swinging at them to get them off of you is potentially a reasonable response.
I run into you in a busy train station, and your response is to punch me. Is that evidence of self-defense?
Depending on the circumstances, possibly.
Just assume you just have the facts I've described and nothing more.
That would be a jury question, whether or not that was reasonable under the circumstances.
Is that sufficient evidence to create a subjective belief requiring the state then have the burden of proving the absence of self-defense?
If the person was no longer, I'm resisting your hypothetical, Your Honor, because I think that there is more to it than that. If I were to run into you in a crowded train station, presumably you would continue moving on. And therefore, if I swing at you after the fact, I've had to chase you to do so or something to that effect, which is a very different situation from this, where we're in a tight.
I run into you and I can't get by you because of all the crowded people.
Okay.
So I'm right face to face, and your first response is to punch me.
Under those circumstances, that does seem unreasonable. But again, that's a jury question. We have a very different set of facts here. The question is whether there's any evidence that he was trying to defend himself. And the fact that we have harmful or offensive contact plus, that very first swing, I don't believe it's clear from the record that this was essentially like a targeted punch. This was swinging in the nature of flailing, trying to get the person off of him, trying to prevent them from continuing to physically contact him.
But doesn't it become very critical because everything from there escalates and requires the intervention of additional people and the additional means and the injection, the handcuffs?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the paramedics and the firefighters also testified that there would have been none of that if they had simply backed off when it became clear to them that he did not want the medical help that they were attempting to administer to him. Both of the paramedics, I believe, and no, I'm sorry, one of the paramedics, one of the firefighters, and one of the officers all testified that it was very clear to them that he did not want the medical intervention that they were trying to essentially force upon him. And the trial court essentially ruled that there is no legal right to self-defense in the face of unwanted medical contact, or that we, and the state has argued.
Did you reflect whether they were trying to take him into custody or to detain him?
The record does not reflect anything that I've been able to determine about that, Your Honor. The only testimony was the officer's testimony that if he had not been taken to the hospital, he would have been arrested.
My understanding is that there's a statute that allows this medical intervention if he is disabled, and that same statute allows them to detain him.
I'm not entirely certain about that, Your Honor. The statute that the state cited refers to a peace officer, not a paramedic or a firefighter, and it refers to a peace officer or a county-designated person. There's been no evidence that these paramedics or firefighters were county-designated people with the lawful authority to take someone into custody. And even if they were, there's very good reason to distinguish medical professionals from law enforcement professionals in terms of whether there's a reasonable right to use self-defense.
Well, don't we want to protect the medical professionals more than the law enforcement people, because presumably they haven't been trained in the same level of self-defense as law enforcement?
Certainly we want to protect medical professionals, but that doesn't mean that we should expand the number of people that are permitted to intrude upon our liberty without our being able to defend ourselves. Essentially, in the realm of law enforcement, there has to be an actual threat of imminent serious injury before you have a right to do anything. You're required to simply submit and then to litigate the lawfulness of the law enforcement conduct in court later. That's not reasonable in the case of unwanted medical contact. For example, what if Mr. Jordan had known he was deathly allergic to Versed, the sedative that they were trying to administer to him, but was for whatever reason unable to articulate that in the moment? There are very good policy reasons not to extend that protection that we give to law enforcement beyond that. I would note that the statute also covers transit operators, essentially bus drivers. So does that mean that we're then also going to say you have no right of self-defense against bus drivers? That would be a dramatic increase in the scope of people that are essentially permitted to intrude upon your physical liberty without you having the right to do anything about it.
Hypothetical, why shouldn't we require Mr. Jordan to first say I'm allergic to some medicines or something rather than beginning with a swing?
Again, that would be a jury question, whether or not he was able to do that, whether or not that would be absolutely necessary as a first step. He might have decided that he needed to get them to stop, and then he could talk about why.
Thank you. You'll have 2 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Excuse me. My name is David Trefry. I'm a deputy prosecuting attorney for the county of Yakima. Excuse me.
Thank you for traveling so far to come this morning.
I've now had all three of the courts of appeal and the Supreme Court, so it was well worth the trip, Your Honor. I think the court hit the crux of the problem on the head. What we have here is we have EMTs who come into a location, a public location, and you find a person who is literally passed out in a bathroom, in a stall. They can't get him to arouse. They try the painful stimuli, but when he actually comes awake and has that first swing, that first punch, they've stopped anything like that. They're trying to put him on a backboard. They've rolled him on his side, and all of a sudden he just pops awake, and then the punches start.
So what is the contact at the time that he strikes out? Someone has a hold of his head?
The physical contact, yeah. In the record, what the EMT says he was attempting to do at that time, Your Honor, is he was just starting to put a C-collar on because they thought that there was a head injury. What they were seeing here with is non-responsive. The three level that they had for response was the same as coma. So they were, with what little information they have a man down who's totally non-responsive, and there was a lot of information the defense tried to elicit as far as the smell of alcohol, and that's just, it's a red herring. The fact is you have an individual, whether it's alcohol or a head injury, who is totally non-responsive. So the actual physical contact at the point when the swing started was he had been rolled on his shoulders, on his side, and they were attempting to put a C-collar on. And that's when his eyes popped open, and he started swinging and kicking. And I won't go into the verbiage, but the verbiage was very limited in this.
But the sternum rub was over. There was no infliction of pain at that point. But someone was then holding his head, and someone else was attempting to put a collar on?
Correct. At that point in time, the only two individuals who were present and touching Mr. Jordan were both EMTs, one at his feet and one at his head. The firefighters had arrived, but they were standing outside. Remember, this is approximately 5x10 bathroom stall. It's one of the handicap stalls, so it's large, but they had just arrived. So if you read it chronologically, there's just people that slowly started arriving. And it must be noted that the Versed went on at 3 minutes, according to what timing we have. So this was an incredibly fast-moving situation where what you have is two first responders coming in. They're directed to this location. You have a man down. They start emergency procedure.
The Versed was decided to use the Versed and inject after the first punch?
Correct. He was already swinging, and at that point in time when Versed went on, it was when the firefighters had arrived, and they're standing outside. And he comes to because the C-collar is starting to go on, and he starts to react. And then that's when we have some of the firefighters come in, and they start holding. The police aren't here yet.
Okay, so the violent reaction comes before any effort to administer any medication.
Exactly. There's no actual sticking of a needle in his body. The only contact that could be considered offensive is rolling him on his side to attempt to administer this limited aid at this point in time, the C-collar, to support his neck because they're thinking seizure or head injury.
So he wakes up and somebody's got a hold of his head.
Correct.
And he lashes out.
Correct.
Shouldn't we infer that he responded to that physical stimulus, that someone was hanging onto his head as unwanted physical contact?
Which takes you can infer that. Yes, you can, because he's passed out. I mean, this would be like something that we can all perceive. It'd be sound asleep, and suddenly someone wakes you up. Or you're walking into a room, and someone jumps out and scares you. It's going to be that type of reaction. I can see that with Mr. Jordan.
Well, go down that path.
The next path is reasonable, though. What is reasonable in a response from Mr. Jordan after he realizes that these people are standing there in uniform saying to him over and over and over, we're here to help you. What's wrong? We're just here to help you. Every single individual who testified said we had a conversation with him. The conversation was mainly one way because they kept saying, what's wrong? We're here to help you. And he said,
right.
Every time.
But no words came out before he threw the first punch.
No.
The question
Nothing.
I think we're trying to ask is, his immediate response to coming to is to strike out at the person who's holding his head, putting on the collar.
Right.
We infer that is, he's then fearful and he's acting in self-defense, because from there it's a cascade.
It's not. Because the first punch you might get, it's like the first bite with a dog. But then after that, you have knowledge, and he has knowledge, and it's a reasonable standard. And in this situation, he is mandated in the self-defense to take a reasonable action in response to this alleged assault. And once again, how do you get to assault when it's a medical procedure? What is offensive about that? I can understand the startle effect.
First wake up, you may not know it's a medical procedure. All you know is somebody's got their hands on your head.
But does that meet the definition of an offensive contact? It is a contact.
Well, that actually isn't. The test is whether he was in danger of injury.
Injury, correct. Which he was not in danger of injury.
Doesn't get you there. You've got to anticipate that you're going to have some injury.
Right, and you can't get to that with this, because what you have is you have medical personnel who are attempting to do good things for him, not injure him. So you don't even get to the part where he can say it's an offensive, harmful touching, because these are people who are trained to help him.
Well, counsel is suggesting, I think, that we're invading the province of the jury by concluding that no reasonable person could conclude that they were in danger of injury when they first come to with someone else's hands on their head.
I think then what you have to do is you step back to the very beginning of the question of how do you get a self-defense instruction before a jury, and that goes back to way back in this is the level of review. Is this de novo or is this discretionary? And the one ruling he says, he kind of mushes it together. However, if you look at the report of proceedings, page 210, because I'm going through this all again yesterday, he says specifically, I'm not going to give it because of the facts. Quote, I've ruled as a matter of law that he can't argue self-defense with these facts, period. So this is discretionary. This isn't de novo. So then what you have is you have a judge who has sat through this entire trial, which you did, listening to the entire procedure, who knows all this information, who realizes, and standing here as the state, it always amazes me that someone can claim self-defense. You didn't harm me. I have offense with what you've done, and sit and say nothing. I can understand in a case where the evidence might get you there if you had witnesses who said, like, I believe it was the Florida case actually has an interesting fact pattern, because that was a man in the emergency room. He was, I believe, self-admitted for something. He wanted to leave. The security people said, no, you can't. So they started grabbing him. But the facts in that case say very specifically there was a dialogue. There was a communication. And you don't have that. So what you do is you go back to this standard in self-defense. And it's a really low standard. The state realizes that. It is just one of the most minimal standards now. In fact, most of the time in trials, the state walks away when there's one of these offered just because it is not worth having to come stand before you three.
Been a good decision here.
No, because there was no evidence here, Your Honor. I mean, when you look at this record, all you have is the guttural comments, which I'll tell you as a person standing in front of you, I'd really like to say just so I could say I said it in front of the court, but that's all you have. Over and over and over again, where you have, I believe by the time you're done, I believe seven personnel who say, we're here to help you. We're here to help you. And all he does is kick and bite and scream over and over. He doesn't say, please, after the first punch, stop doing this. This offends me. My religion says you shouldn't do this to me. And we have multiple minutes. The Versed didn't kick in. It wasn't into his IV tube because they couldn't put one in. It was intramuscular, went into his butt. It takes a long time to take effect. He had plenty of time to consider his situation. He voluntarily put himself in that bathroom. He knew where he was. Every one of these people was in uniform. And up till the time he got punched in the face, everyone was just saying flat out, we're here to do nothing but help you. He did nothing but scream obscenities, bite, and kick. That is not enough evidence to get you to self-defense, even in that minimal standard. It's not there. So unless the court has any other questions, the state would ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court. It was a discretionary standard. The conviction should stand.
Thank you, counsel.
I think the question here, Your Honor, is you have medical professionals that are telling you they're here to help you. They're doing things to you. Are you required to take their word for it? Or can you physically resist and physically try to stop them from doing what they're doing?
Okay, what injury did Mr. Jordan believe he was in danger of suffering when he took his first swing?
It could be any number of things. We know they had administered painful stimuli. He may not have, he was just waking up. He may not have known what he was in danger of being injured. All he knew was, as Your Honor pointed out, there were people holding his head. He had been, pinched. He'd been had the painful sternum rub that's intended to be painful. So under those circumstances, he shouldn't be required to identify specifically some injury. He should be permitted to try to get these people off of him. And whether or not the level of force that he used was reasonable would be a question for the jury. And I would proffer that also the level of force he used was actually insufficient in order to achieve his goal. So it was actually less than was necessary. No matter what he did, he couldn't get them to stop. Even if he had, clearly and calmly said, I'd like to refuse your medical treatment, we shouldn't require politeness as part of our self-defense standard. And even if he had, the paramedics testified that they had already determined that he was incompetent and therefore they were going to substitute his judgment for his. So even if he had made some clear verbal assertion, that would almost certainly have been insufficient under the testimony of the medical providers. The self-defense standard is about looking at things from the viewpoint of the defendant, whether his act was reasonable under the circumstances as they appeared to him.
There are two parts to that. First part being how the circumstances appeared, which is a subjective test, and then whether the response was reasonable, which is an objective test.
That's correct, Your Honor. And just if I may finish briefly, a reasonable person could conclude that unwanted medical contact required physical resistance. So we would ask the court to reverse those three convictions. Thank you.
Thank you.